Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 237. It's Monday, November 20th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Okay, folks, well, let's get to it. A big news story. This from the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy. COVID increased gender life expectancy gap in U.S. Big story. This has been brewing for years, but it just took a quantum leap. For more than 100 years, American women have outlived American men, largely due to differences in rating cardiovascular disease and lung cancer. Now, COVID-19 has widened the gender life expectancy gap, according to a research letter published in JAMA Internal Medicine. The study was based on mortality data from the National Center for Health Statistics, and it compared life expectancy at birth between men and women from 2010 to 2021, divided by pre- and post-COVID-19 years with cause-specific mortality, and the gap grew to almost 6 years. It's already been well documented that the COVID-19 pandemic lowered life expectancy rates for all U.S. adults, with life expectancy at birth decreasing from 78.8 years in 2019 prior to the pandemic to 76.1 years in 2021. In 2010, U.S. women were expected to live 4.8 years longer than male counterparts, but by 2021, that gap increased to 5.8 years. From 2010 to 2019, the gender life expectancy gap had already increased by a quarter of a year. From 2019 to 2021, it increased by 0.7 years, the gap between men and women, that is. From 2019 to 2021, COVID-19 became the leading contributor to the widening gender life expectancy gap at about a widening of a third of a year. That's about 40% of the increase in the gap, followed by unintentional injuries, about a quarter of year widening, which is about a third of the gap. From 2010 to 2019, the gender mortality gap was caused by unintentional injuries, diabetes, suicide, homicide, and heart disease. The bottom line is men have more comorbidities. The absolute difference in age-adjusted death rates between men and women increased from 252 to 315 per 100,000 from the years 2010 to 2021. So that's over a 20% increase. Yikes. Men experience higher mortality rate from COVID-19 for many reasons, mostly because they carry a higher burden of comorbidities that makes them susceptible to severe COVID. Men also experience more socioeconomic factors, including incarceration and homelessness, that have been linked to COVID-19 deaths. Differentially worsening mortality from diabetes, heart disease, homicide, and suicide suggests that chronic metabolic disease and mental illness may also contribute, the authors said. They also note that increasing deaths of despair among men spotlight the contributions that drug use and firearms make in the gendered age gap. Well, that's bad news for men, perhaps a little bit better news for women. Okay, well, a lot of things changed during the pandemic. Here's another one, another change that was driven by the pandemic. This from Axios. Number of people walking declined steeply in the U.S. There's been a staggering decline in the number of trips Americans taken by putting one foot in front of the other, per a new report. Why does it matter? Walking is good for us. That's true both on an individual level, thanks to the many benefits it confers, and in the big picture climate change sense, given that it's the on-ground form of zero emissions travel. Driving the news, The number of annual average daily walking trips dropped a whopping 36% in the contiguous U.S. between 2019 and 2022, per a new Streetlight data report. In every metro and state that Streetlight analyzed, walking trips declined over the three-year period by at least 20%. Streetlight measures travel behavior based on anonymized data from mobile devices, vehicle GPS systems, and more. From this analysis, one walking trip is any trip taken by foot that is more than 250 meters, or about 820 feet, from start to finish. The intrigue? Active transportation, that is walking and biking, accounted for just 10% of overall trips in 2022, down from 14% in 2019. Driving, however, is only 4% below 2019 levels, yet another sign that America is a country of car lovers. So much for all that walking people were doing during the COVID-19 pandemic. It's clear the pandemic had an obvious impact, Streetlight says. But beyond that, the group isn't sure what's keeping Americans off their feet. Some of this could be remote work, which can make it all too easy to become overly sedentary. And some of it could be part of the downtown recovery story. If a city has fewer restaurants, shops, and so on open, there's less reason for locals and visitors to have a walkabout. Okay, well, let's get to a couple Ohio stories. This is from Axios. Planned Parenthood to invest in Ohio following abortion amendment. Ohio's largest abortion services provider is looking to the future. Erica Wilson-Domer, CEO of Planned Parenthood of Greater Ohio, said the amendment will enable Planned Parenthood to make investments in staffing and facilities it had previously put off, including exploring adding facilities near the state's borders. It has been incredibly challenging to staff for abortion services and recruit providers to the state given the previous restrictions. We are incredibly hopeful with the passing of Issue 1 that it will be easier to recruit providers that want to come to Ohio, knowing that reproductive rights have been enshrined in the Constitution here. Wilson-Domer said a major focus for Planned Parenthood will be providing services to out-of-state patients. Ohio borders three states, Indiana, Kentucky, and West Virginia, that have abortion bans. We have an obligation and responsibility now, with this right enshrined in Ohio, to provide access not just to Ohioans, but all the people who are not able to access, Wilson-Domer said. And in another Ohio story, this from WOSU.org, CDC reports increase in kindergarten vaccine exemptions. Ohio is above the national average for exemptions. The CDC said the rate of kindergartners exempted from school vaccinations has hit the highest level ever at a national average of 3% in the 2022-2023 school year, up from 2.6%. Ohio's exemption rate is just above the national rate at 3.8%, which is up 0.8% from the previous school year. Ohio law allows students to be exempted from vaccines for medical reasons or, quote, reasons of conscience, which includes religious reasons. The CDC estimates about 89% of Ohio's nearly 135,000 kindergartners are fully vaccinated for diphtheria, tetanus, polio, measles, mumps, and rubella. Some others are partially vaccinated or in a vaccination grace period. The national average for full vaccination is about 93%, slightly lower than before the COVID-19 pandemic, when the national vaccination rate was at 95% in the 2019 to 2020 school year. And in a somewhat related story, going more worldwide, this from Reuters, staggering rise in measles cases last year, says World Health Organization and CDC. There was a staggering annual rise in measles cases and deaths in 2022, according to a new report from the WHO and the CDC. Cases jumped by 18% to an estimated 9 million and deaths to 136,000, mostly among children, the health agency said in a joint statement. There were large and disruptive outbreaks in 37 countries last year, the majority in Africa, compared to 22 in 2021. The increase in measles outbreaks and deaths is staggering, but fortunately not unexpected given the declining vaccination rates we've seen in the past few years, said John Vertufuelle, director of the CDC's Global Immunization Division. The COVID-19 pandemic massively disrupted routine immunization efforts worldwide, and the bounce back has been slow. Measles is one of the most contagious viruses in the world, but is preventable by two doses of vaccine. However, 22 million children worldwide missed their first dose in 2022, an additional 11 million their second dose, a slight improvement on the previous year. However, the situation has not recovered at all since the pandemic in low-income countries, where the risk of dying of measles is highest, said the WHO. Coverage rates there are at 66% on average, compared to the 95% the UN agency says is needed to prevent outbreaks. This is an alarm bell for action for countries and all global health stakeholders. Okay, well, let's return to the U.S. on an issue that the United States rocks out as number one. This from MedPage Today. Americans struggling with addiction and mental health, new drug survey shows. The Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration released the results of its 2022 National Survey on Drug Use and Health, which showed that nearly one in five Americans aged 12 and older reported having a substance use disorder in the past year, and roughly one in four adults reported having a mental illness. While the nation has made some progress, there's still more work to be done, said Rahul Gupta, director of the Office of National Drug Control Policy. There are currently more than 48 million Americans struggling with substance use disorders, and three out of every four are not getting the treatment they need. We need to close this gap, and we need to make sure that everyone who needs treatment can get it. In a recent supplemental funding request, the Biden administration called for over $1.5 billion to improve and expand treatments for substance use disorder, overdose prevention measures, and recovery support services, as well as more than $1.2 billion to, quote, crack down on drug trafficking, a press release from HHS noted. I'll also note that this is a long-standing division where you spend a lot of money on interdiction. Here they're spending a little bit more on treatment and prevention, but this has been a long-standing, basically, interdiction doesn't really work very well. You're much better off putting it, instead of dealing with a supply issue, deal with a demand issue and do prevention and treatment. Okay, back to the story. The National Survey on Drug Use and Health captures nationally representative, self-reported data on substance use disorders and mental health conditions, including suicidal thoughts and behaviors and use of substance use and mental health treatment. Looking at the key findings on past month substance use, about 60% of adolescents and adults 12 and older use alcohol at almost 49%, tobacco at 18%, or an illicit drug 16.5%, or vaped nicotine 8.3%. Among adolescents, 7.3% of those aged 12 to 17 used tobacco or vape nicotine in the past month. In 2022, 48.7 million adolescents and adults reported a substance use disorder in the past year, including 29.5 million with alcohol use disorder, 27.2 million with a drug use disorder, and 8 million with both. Of the 137.4 million current alcohol users 12 and older, 44.5% were past month binge drinkers. The share of people who engage in binge drinking in the past month was highest among those aged 18 to 25 at almost 30%, followed by adults aged 26 and older at 23%. Of adolescents 12 to 17, 3.2% reported binge drinking. Marijuana was the most commonly used illicit drug at 22%, with young adults aged 18 to 25 making up the highest percentage of marijuana users at over 38%. Of the 8.9 million people who misused opioids in the past year, 8.5 million misused prescription painkillers and 1 million misused heroin. An additional nearly million people misused prescription fentanyl or illegally made fentanyl. Importantly, Miriam Delphin Rittman, the Associate Secretary for Mental Health and Substance Use, said the survey data showed no difference by racial and ethnic groups in the percentage of people who received substance use treatment in the past year among people who needed it. Among the more promising findings, she noted, out of the 21.3 million adults who believe they had a substance use disorder, consider themselves to be in recovery or to have recovered. Looking at mental health conditions, 59 million or 23% of adults reported any mental illness in the past year. 5% of adults had serious suicidal thoughts, 1.5% made a suicide plan, and 0.6% attempted suicide. White and multiracial adults were more likely than Black, Hispanic, or Asian adults to receive mental health treatment at any time in the past year. As for adolescents aged 12 to 17, nearly 5 million experienced a major depressive episode in the past year. 13.4% had serious thoughts of suicide, 6.5% made a suicide plan, and 3.7% attempted suicide. And you'll notice those numbers are higher for the adolescents 12 to 17 than the adults. Yes, we have a youth mental health crisis. Okay, well, in another updated health status report for the U.S., on preterm labor, U.S. gets a failing grade again in new report. This from USA Today. The U.S. fails again in report on preterm birth, a leading cause of infant mortality. The U.S. has landed another poor grade when it comes to preterm births, with festering disparities in outcomes for Black and Native women that are life-threatening, according to a new annual report. Preterm birth, when babies are born before 37 weeks gestation, is among the leading causes of infant death in the U.S., according to the March of Dimes. Outcomes across the country improved only slightly this year. In 2021, just over 1 in 10 babies were born preterm, and that was true again in 2022. Because of this, March of Dimes, a decades-old health nonprofit for mothers and babies, gave the U.S. a D-plus grade, the same as in the previous year, in its State of Maternal and Infant Health for American Families report card just published. Ashley Stoneburner, a data scientist with March of Dimes, who is a report author, said it's hard to make sense of why mothers and babies are so at risk. We live in one of the wealthiest nations, and our health of moms and families is getting worse year after year. The report comes amid spikes in national infant maternal mortality rates that have disparate impact on communities across race, class, and geographical boundaries. All these indicators are connected, Stoneburner said, and preterm birth is just the tip of the iceberg. Factors that exacerbate preterm birth include pre-pregnancy hypertension and diabetes, as well as smoking, unhealthy weight, and previous preterm birth, the report said. The report showed gaps in women's and infants' health among these fault lines. Black and Native women were 54% more likely to have preterm deliveries than white women. Babies born to Black and Indigenous mothers had death rates 2.3 times higher than those born to white and Hispanic mothers. The infant mortality rate also increased overall. As data from the National Centers for Health Statistics showed recently, an uptick for the first time in two decades. Maternal deaths doubled from 2018 to 2021, and the greater increases were among Black and Native women. The fact is, we are not prioritizing the health of moms and babies in this country, the president and CEO of March of Dimes said in a statement. Yep, where are those family values when you need them? Okay, well, next up, a new home screening test is available. This from Stat News. FDA grants approval for first time for a home test for chlamydia and gonorrhea. The FDA granted marketing approval to a home test for chlamydia and gonorrhea, the first such authorization of a home test to detect the two most common sexually transmitted infections in this country. The marketing approval was granted to Let's Get Checked Simple 2 test, which allows individuals to collect a sample at home that is then submitted to a laboratory for processing. Prior to this, the only approved tests for these two sexually transmitted infections required samples to be collected at medical facilities, such as doctor's offices. This authorization marks an important public health milestone, giving patients more information about their health from the privacy of their own home, said Jeff Shuren, director of FDA Center for Devices and Radiological Health. We are eager to continue supporting greater consumer access to diagnostic tests, which helps further our goal of bringing more healthcare into the home. This simple 2 test will be available over-the-counter and is intended for use by people age 18 and older. The only other sexually transmitted infection test that allows for home sample collection is for HIV. This option is exceptionally useful for individuals who live in rural areas or are geographically distant from a clinic where sexually transmitted infection testing can be done and there is no telehealth option available. If a person screens positive, they can then contact a healthcare provider for further evaluation and treatment. Rates of new infections of chlamydia and gonorrhea have been soaring in the U.S. The CDC estimates there were more than 1.6 million cases of chlamydia in 2021 and over 710,000 cases of gonorrhea the same year. Both infections are curable, but if left untreated, can trigger serious long-term effects, including infertility. Home samples are taken either using vaginal swabs or urine samples, which are then submitted to a designated laboratory. Results are delivered online, with follow-up care provided when a diagnosis is positive or ambiguous. Okay, and yet another health status report update, this from Associated Press. Progress in childhood cancer has stalled for Blacks and Hispanics, report says. Advances in childhood cancer are a success story in modern medicine, but in the past decade, those strides have stalled for Black and Hispanic youth, opening a gap in death rates, according to a new report published. Childhood cancers are rare and treatments have improved drastically in recent decades, saving lives. Death rates were about the same for Black, Hispanic, and white children in 2001, and all went lower during the next decade. But over the next 10 years, only the rate for white children dipped a little lower. You can have the most sophisticated scientific advances, But if you can't deliver them into every community in the same way, then we have not met our goal as a nation, said Dr. Sharon Castellino, a pediatric cancer specialist at Emory University's Cancer Institute in Atlanta, who had no role in the new report. She said the complexity of new cancer treatments, such as gene therapy, which can cure some children with leukemia, can burden families and be an impediment to getting care. You need at least one parent to quit their job and be there 24/7, and then figure out the situation for the rest of their children. It's not that families don't want to do that, it's difficult. More social workers are needed to help families file paperwork, to get job-protected leave, and make sure the child's health insurance is current and doesn't lapse. The overall cancer death rate for children and teenagers in the U.S. declined 24% over the last two decades, according to the CDC. The 2021 rate per 10,000 children was 1.99 for whites, but 2.38 for black youth, and 2.36 for Hispanic youth. Nearly incurable 50 years ago, childhood cancer is now survivable for most patients, especially those with leukemia. The leading cause of cancer deaths in kids is now brain cancer, which has replaced leukemia. Each year in the U.S., about 15,000 children and teens are diagnosed with cancer. More than 85% live for at least 5 years. Well, and that story highlights the fact that an availability of a service doesn't necessarily mean access, a very important public health principle. You need access beyond just mere availability. And this next story from the Commonwealth Fund gets just at that and how the U.S. compares to other high-income countries. The cost of not getting care, income disparities, and the affordability of healthcare services across high-income countries. Over the past four decades, government and individual health spending as a share of the overall economy has been steadily rising around the world, partly because of advances in medical technologies and greater demand for health services. In the United States, where administrative costs and healthcare prices are far higher than in other high-income countries, this increased spending has meant higher insurance premiums and deductibles. Nearly a quarter of the U.S. population is covered by a health plan all year that doesn't ensure affordable access to care. Now, that's just the people that have healthcare that are insurance. That doesn't include the folks that don't even have any health insurance at all. The U.S. is the only high-income country without universal health coverage. About 8% of the population is uninsured. But universal coverage, while critical to ensuring that healthcare is accessible and affordable, is not always enough. Even some countries that provide coverage to all their citizens grapple with rising healthcare costs, which can trickle down to patients in the form of higher out-of-pocket costs and, for those with private plans, higher premiums. These costs most severely impact households with low incomes, people of color, and rural residents. Some of the highlights: adults in the United States face wider income-related disparities in healthcare affordability compared to adults in other high-income countries. Adults in the U.S. with lower or average incomes are more likely to skip needed medical care and have problems paying medical bills than in all the other countries in this analysis. In the U.S., adults with higher incomes are more likely to have healthcare affordability problems, including cost-related access issues and medical bill problems, than their counterparts in most other countries. People with unmet social needs are more likely to need more intensive and expensive medical interventions, making more frequent trips to the emergency room, and face financial barriers to care. In nearly every country surveyed, adults with lower or average incomes are more likely than their counterparts with higher incomes to have at least one unmet social need. This includes not having enough food, struggling to meet rent or mortgage payments, lacking a clean and safe place to sleep, or not having a stable job or income. Research shows that social drivers of health like these can account for up to 50% of health outcomes. And as a note, that's compared to basically what healthcare itself provides is approximately 20% of the difference in health outcomes for folks. So getting to these social drivers, these social determinants of health, are extremely important and take us way beyond what we think of as the medical care system. Okay, well, next up, let's do a story on occupational exposure. This from Medical Express. Current uses of asbestos exceed exposure limits. You might be wondering, isn't asbestos illegal? Well, it's not. A new study summarizing asbestos exposure during the installation and removal of asbestos cement products demonstrates that these construction activities almost always exceed U.S. occupational limits. The study focused on airborne asbestos exposures from existing uses of asbestos that are still allowed in most countries. average task-specific asbestos exposures during the cutting of asbestos cement pipe were more than 50 times the Occupational Safety and Health Administration's short-term limit. Cutting asbestos boards and corrugated roofing results in an average exposure 24 times the limit. Asbestos cement products, including pipe, siding, and roofing, account for more than 90% of global asbestos use. We found that exposures from asbestos cement products could be alarmingly high and certainly disprove the asbestos industry's contention that these materials can be used in a, quote, safe and responsible manner, said Perry Gottesfeld, Executive Director of Occupational Knowledge International and the author of the study. The study demonstrates that there is an immediate need to ban all asbestos cement products that are sold in many countries, as these are still being installed in millions of homes and commercial buildings. Although more than 60 countries have banned the use of asbestos, the U.S. EPA is only now considering a total ban of asbestos cement and other existing uses. Currently, the EPA only requires companies to notify the agency before manufacturing or importing asbestos cement products. Wow, so they know they're out there, but they don't regulate them. Yikes. You are listening to Just for the Health of It and WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, on the show, Just for the Health of It, reporting a lot of things that could be described as problems. And assessment, of course, is a major part of public health. And knowing the problem, it gets you halfway to the solution. But, of course, 50% is a failing grade. But we do know that there are a lot of things that can improve that are available in our toolbox should we choose to use them. The story next gets to that. This is from Stat News. Type 2 diabetes prevention programs can work at large-scale, study finds. Clinical trials have shown that lifestyle programs, which include diet, exercise, and behavioral coaching, can help people in danger of developing type 2 diabetes from tipping into a diagnosis of the condition. But there's been a nagging question of whether such intensive regimens work in the real world. A study published recently backs up the idea that they can. Researchers behind the work relied on novel statistical approaches to analyze millions of records from England's National Health Service and found that participants in the diabetes prevention program saw improvements in risk factors for type 2 diabetes, indicating that patients can benefit from such initiatives even outside the confines of a controlled experiment. Patients were only eligible for the program if they have blood glucose levels, known as HbA1c, of at least 6%. An elevated HbA1c indicates that a person may have what's called prediabetes, meaning they're essentially at risk for the condition. For the researchers, that eligibility cutoff enables them to build a study that was based on real-world data, but what included so-called quasi-experimental approaches. They could analyze data from patients on either side of that threshold and track how their glycemic control, as well as other risk factors, changed based on their eligibility and participation in the program. The researchers relied on statistical methods that are more commonly used in the social sciences than in epidemiology, but that are designed to determine whether an intervention has a causal effect, not just an association with an outcome. And indeed, they found that people referred to the program had a drop in the HbA1c levels of 0.85 based on one of the analyses. Our study not only demonstrates the potential of intensive lifestyle counseling for improving the health of patients with prediabetes in routine care, but potentially also suggests a promising route for improving population health more broadly, the authors wrote. The study primarily focused on changes in blood glucose levels, but they also saw improvements in other risk factors, such as body mass index and weight. There were, however, no statistical effects on some markers, such as certain cholesterol levels, and on complications from diabetes or emergency hospitalizations for cardiovascular issues, though the authors noted they were studying a short follow-up period. The question of whether behavioral interventions work at a broad scale is important, not just for the health of patients. Health systems also want to make sure they are getting value out of such intensive efforts. But having such a program is different than getting patients to participate and helping them stick with it. The researchers reported that only 17.4% of eligible patients were referred to intensive lifestyle counseling. In an editorial that was published alongside the study, they noted that the improvements in HbA1c were greater among people who participated in the program, on par with what past trials have shown, versus those who were referred but did not participate, and even more so than those of everyone who was eligible. The cascade of lowered risk, which was greatest in those who actively participated in the program, reflects the crux of the challenge for individual-level prevention approaches. The success of these strategies depends heavily on strong engagement and adherence to the program, and perhaps the identification of people who respond well to lifestyle interventions in the first place. It is also a reminder that approaches targeted to the individual cannot go it alone. A combination of individual and population-based approaches that address a wide variety of risk factors are needed to change the course of the type 2 diabetes epidemic. And of course, a classic example of that is shown in high-income countries, particularly the U.S. first, our food system, which has been ultra-processed and highly processed foods, and that is unfortunately spreading like wildfire throughout the world. As we've saturated markets in the so-called developed world, they're moving to low and middle income countries. This type of intervention, by having a higher quality diet for the entire population, can not only affect just type 2 diabetes, but cardiovascular disease, cancer, and a whole host of chronic diseases. Okay, well, one very large social determinant of health is trust in our society. And this next article gets at the public's trust in scientists. This from Stat News. One quarter of Americans have little or no confidence in scientists to act in public's best interest. America's trust in scientists and positive views of science has continued to decline, according to a new report. The Pew Research Center, a nonpartisan think tank, asked a random sample of almost 9,000 American adults this fall about their views on science and scientists. They found that roughly a quarter of Americans, that is 27%, said they have not too much or no confidence in scientists to act in the public's best interest, compared to 12% who said the same thing in April 2020. Ratings of medical scientists mirror the trend seen in ratings of scientists generally, the report notes. People with high trust in science are more likely to engage in behaviors that align with expert guidance, such as getting vaccinated for COVID-19 and the flu. However, the share expressing the strongest level of trust in scientists fell from 39% to 23%. So the distrust end of the spectrum more than doubled from 12% to 27%, and the high level diminished from 39% down to 23%. The percentage of Americans who hold a positive view of science impact on society has also declined in recent years. In the new survey, 57% of respondents said science had a mostly positive effect on society, compared to 65% in November of 2021. Despite recent declines in public sentiment, it's also true that 73% of U.S. adults say they have a great deal or fair amount of confidence in scientists to act in the public's best interest. I continue to appreciate there's still a lot more positive views about scientists than negative views, and that they're still among the most positively viewed groups compared to other people in other professions, said John Besley, professor of public relations at Michigan State University, who studies public attitudes toward science. By comparison, just 35% of Americans expressed confidence in business leaders acting in the public's best interest, and 24% said the same of elected officials. Okay, well, last up in reporting, I'd like to do a story that's sort of a follow-up to that last one about trust and mistrust, and perhaps answer a little bit of the question, how might we knit back some of that fraying of human connection that's leading to distrust in society? This from NPR, how daily moments of joy can help long-term well-being. Can little actions bring joy? Researchers find microacts can boost well-being. It's 8 a.m. and your inbox is filling up. You spot an email about a colleague's promotion. Do you scroll past it or take a moment to give props? Or you're in line at the coffee shop where it's easy to tune everyone out. But today you decide to pick up a tab for the person behind you. How might a small act like this influence your mood later today, tonight, or throughout the week? Recently released analysis from scientists behind a research initiative called the Big Joy Project finds that people who commit daily to micro acts of joy experience about a 25% increase in emotional well-being over the course of a week. We're really excited, said Emiliana Simon-Thomas, a Big Joy Project leader and science director of the Greater Good Science Center at the University of California, Berkeley. There are statistically significant measurable changes, including greater well-being, better coping, less stress, and more satisfaction with relationships. The Big Joy Project is a collaboration between UC Berkeley's Greater Good Science Center and other research institutions. So far, the researchers have preliminary results from over 70,000 participants in more than 200 countries. What we've really focused on is understanding impact and the potential for change in people's lives. Overall, the new analysis shows microacts lead to increased feelings of hope, optimism, as well as moments of fun or silliness. This project did not begin as a typical research study, but rather a citizen science project, which is still open to anyone who wants to participate. Here's how it works. Participants take an online survey to answer questions about their emotions, stress, and their social tendencies. Then, every day for 7 consecutive days, they agree to try small, happiness-boosting activities, what the researchers have dubbed micro-acts of joy. All the recommended micro-acts have been linked to emotional well-being in prior published studies. Examples include making a gratitude list or journal, or engaging in acts of kindness such as visiting a sick neighbor, or doing a nice gesture for a friend or a stranger. Some micro-acts involve celebrating another person's joy, or engaging in self-reflection, meditation, or taking the time to identify the silver lining in a bad situation, known as positive reframing. Each day, people answer questions about what they did and how they felt afterwards. At the end of the week, they take another survey to gauge how their emotions and sense of well-being have changed. When people intentionally plan out a daily micro-act, it may help them feel as if they have a bit of control over their emotions, explains researcher Alyssa Eppel, a Big Joy collaborator and a professor of psychiatry at the University of California, San Francisco. So there's this feeling of agency, and that could be one explanation for the improvements in well-being seen in the survey. For instance, participants were asked how much they agreed with the statement, "I have felt able to impact, influence, or play an active role in how happy I generally feel." The participants' level of agreement with the statement increased by 27% over the course of the week. Since all participants chose to be part of the project, it's likely they were hoping for a benefit, but it's not clear if everyone, even people who don't believe small acts can be beneficial, would see the same result. We haven't randomly assigned a group of people who do the 7-day program, so without control group data, the results are all preliminary. The researchers plan to run some controlled studies and publish results in the future. At a time when global conflicts, political divide, and societal problems may seem insurmountable, some may question whether small acts of joy can help make a difference. The answer, researchers say, stems from the ideas of the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who both spoke about how it's possible to feel joy even in the midst of suffering, and to use that feeling to help do good. The Big Joy Project began as a collaboration with documentary filmmakers who produced a 2021 film called Mission, Joy, which aimed to illuminate this message. They really wanted to spread the wisdom that we have more control over happiness than we know. Eppel has spent decades studying how stress affects the body, and she says it's been surprising to see the benefits of micro acts of joy. These very short practices are clearly having a positive residue. She comes to think of the micro acts as tools at our fingertips that we can use in the moment to relieve feelings of stress, anxiety, and worry. Of course, it's important to point out what micro acts cannot accomplish. They are not a replacement for therapy or medications used for serious mental health challenges, including depression. And the researchers point out, it's also not appropriate to think micro-acts can help overhaul the struggles of someone whose basic needs are not being met. It would be embarrassing and shameful to be like, "Hey, you don't have enough to eat, why don't you try Big Joy?" But she says the hope is that the joy that emanates from micro-acts may help spur some people to get involved in the greater good, whether it's in your community, your workplace, your school, or an organization you admire. What you're hoping is that when people finish Big Joy, they have the sense that, oh, my happiness is contingent in part on how generous and invested I am in common humanity. At a time when random acts of kindness could be viewed as bumper sticker cliche, researchers say it's important to continue to nail down potential benefits through rigorous studies. "I appreciate the skepticism," says Judith Moskowitz, a social scientist at Northwestern University School of Medicine, who is not involved in the Big Joy analysis. The body of research on positive psychology has to date produced mixed results, and Moskowitz says the ongoing research creates an opportunity to better understand the effects of these small steps. Moskowitz's own research has shown a series of small steps that are similar to those used in the Big Joy Project can help people cope during bad situations. For instance, she found caregivers caring for a sick loved one were able to tamp down anxiety after going through a 5-week course. So many of these things that are causing us stress and sadness are out of our control. So these micro moments can give you something to hold on to, she explains, and help you stay engaged. Decades of research have shown that even in the context of really stressful events or sickness, there's absolutely the capacity to experience moments of positive emotion as well, she says. Rather than thinking of joy as something that happens to you, it may make sense to think of it as a skill that you can get better at through practice. If you want to stay physically fit, you have to keep exercising. And the same likely goes for well-being, she says. Just as the benefits of exercise wear off, so too do the effects of these microags. I feel optimistic, I feel more relaxed, I feel more supported in the world when I engage in these micropractices myself, says Simon Thomas. I just believe that humans can change for the better. One way to get started with the big joy concept is to plan out the moment of your microact each day. Maybe build it into your daily dog walking routine. That's a good time to make a mental gratitude list or look for an opportunity to chat with a neighbor. Part of this is intention setting. If you have a map of where you're going to go, you're more likely to get there, she says. Well, amen to that. The journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. Okay, well, next up, I have our final regular feature, bonus articles. A carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads to increase enrichment. Available online, just like all the stories I reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give the link again at the end of the list. Well, this week we got an even 24 bonus articles. So let's start with number one. Israel battles Hamas near another Gaza hospital sheltering thousands. So I just wanted to lift up and highlight the fact that war and violent conflict is a public health problem, and that there's sort of a crazy juxtaposition of, like in this case, healthcare workers and human rights workers trying to secure a measure of just living, let alone health. And it seems that the Israeli Defense Forces, so-called Defense Forces, are attacking yet another hospital and, of course, bombing civilians. I would posit that these health workers and human rights advocates and peacemongers are actually the heroes, not the soldiers. Bonus Article 2, U.S. military says national security depends on forever chemicals. So perhaps another example of kind of a military law enforcement mentality that is violent, thinking that in order to achieve good ends, we need to poison ourselves. Just like in a civilian sector, forever chemicals might have specific purposes for which they serve well, but we've known from other cultures, like the EU, has been better at developing alternative chemicals or means of reaching an end without using forever toxic chemicals. Bonus Article 3. Most states ban shackling pregnant women in custody, yet many report being restrained. This is another example of where a policy can exist, but it may not be actually what happens in practice. And of course, there's a lot of health risks to shackling pregnant women. So most states, that's actually been banned, but of course it happens a lot. And again, another example, another juxtaposition of whether you've got a health and public health point of view coming in contact with a more militaristic or law enforcement point of view, which tends to have a lot of collateral damage. Bonus Article 4, Ohio has enshrined the right to an abortion, but major obstacles remain for patients and providers. So, with issue 1 passing and a newly enshrined Ohio constitutional right to reproductive rights in Ohio, unfortunately not the full country, but in Ohio, there still are a lot of laws that remain on the books that need to be sorted out. But today, those laws are still in effect, so it's going to take a while. If you want to get a summary of those, that's Bonus Article 4. Bonus Article 5, an Ohio commission approves fracking in state parks and wildlife despite fraud investigation. So this is where a bunch of fracking groups were basically committing fraud. They were putting in people's comments for people who, when they found out about it, said, I never put that in. We're talking about dozens and dozens and dozens of these for public comments trying to get support for fracking in state parks and wildlife areas. And even though that this serious investigation is going on, Ohio is still approving fracking in state parks and wildlife areas. Yep, even the business interests that have a conflict of interest and a likely fraud are still allowed to destroy our environment. Bonus Article 6, how the next Republican president could stop most abortions without Congress by banning mailing of abortion medication. So if you don't think that the next presidential race, that abortion is on the ballot, this is a big reason why. Now, this I've talked about this before. This is that Comstock Act way back in the 19th century. And it's being proposed, another one of these crazy fringe legal ideas, but that through that you could ban the mailing of abortion medication. And of course, this could be an executive order that would eventually be challenged, but it could wreak havoc on abortion access in this country. Bonus Article 7, do your job. How the railroad industry intimidates employees into putting speed before safety. Another example where business interests are overriding the public good and public safety. And as I like to say, most evil can probably fit under the two categories of I was just doing my job or that's not my job. Bonus article number 8 gets the award for the most evilly creative perversion of the law. The unusual way a Catholic health system is wielding an abortion protest law by charging patients refusing to be unsafely discharged with trespassing. So this is supposed to be something about keeping people off the property that were anti-abortion protesters in hospitals. But what they're doing is, in recent years, there's been increasing amount of time, the difficulty of being able to discharge certain patients because they have nowhere safe to go. Either they can't afford to go to another care facility, and it wouldn't be safe for them to go home. Hospitals want to get these people out of the hospital, and some patients are refusing to go, knowing that it's unsafe and life-threatening. And this Catholic health system is, in fact, charging people with trespassing. Yikes. Bonus Article 9. Michigan health official is taking her county to court over $4 million resignation offer after commissioners couldn't fire her without cause. So this is in Ottawa County, Holland, Michigan. Used to be my stomping ground, so I felt a little bit of connection to this. So this is basically a ripple from the COVID-19 pandemic, where the bunch of right-wingers took over the county commissioners because they were unhappy about mask requirements in the county. And now they wanted to fire this commissioner who oversaw those mask restrictions or mask regulations. And when they found out that they couldn't fire her without cause, and, you know, that's another raises levels about their level of competence about what they do and the overreach that they're willing to do. But they offered her $4 million to resign, which is like a quarter of the entire health department budget for the county. And now they're dealing it with a lawsuit. Bonus Article 10. We tried to quantify how harmful hospital ransomware attacks are for patients. So there's a kind of a good news, bad news. These ransomware attacks, because we rely on electronic medical records, there are certain scans and things that can only be done, you know, with computers operating and that type of thing. So it actually is really dangerous and can increase mortality rates like by a quarter or a third while they're kind of locked down with ransomware attacks. The good news, if you can call it that, is that these aren't quite as widespread as they could be, but it's something to look for in the future. So I'm glad somebody's looking at that. Bonus Article 11. New study on hunter-gatherer moms suggests Western childcare has a big problem with little human touch. So this is looking at some hunter-gatherer societies in Africa where literally 10 or 20 people might hold a child during the day to help out the mom. And a child might be held for 5, 10, or more hours a day compared to in the West where kids are in child care where you may have a ratio of, you know, one adult for 6 kids and kids aren't being held very much or having as much human touch. Definitely can create health problems. And probably, you know, one of those things at the basis of why our culture is the most disconnected from one another starts early. Bonus Article 12, it's not all in your head. You do focus differently on Zoom. So this was a very interesting study that really did a whole bunch of measures, you know, brain scans and other measures to try to figure out, you know, how people were focusing on Zoom versus face-to-face, and they found some very profound differences. So I think this is an example of where, you know, Zoom may offer opportunities that didn't exist without it. But if we overly rely on Zoom and move away in lieu of face-to-face encounters, it may result in a net negative as far as a connection and being able to have productive interactions with other people. Bonus article 13, overstressing stress. American Psychological Association report omits oppression. So I reported on this report last week, but of course, as is in most kind of modern professional associations, oppression is usually not really on the screen. It's very much, in this case for Psychology Association, kind of what's between your ears, or it's biochemical, rather than looking at social causes. And for instance, you know, if somebody's oppressed, you know, having them reframe and talk about it, you know, may be a slightly mitigating intervention, but it hardly obviates the root cause of injustice. Bonus article 14, social factors rather than biological ones drive higher numbers of adverse drug events in women. So this is interesting because it fits into one of my pet peeves about always looking for, you know, genetic causes and stuff rather than like social causes. And of course, looking at biological causes rather than social causes is one of the things that leads to reinforce racism and racialization of people. In this case, they were considering that, you know, women were fundamentally different physiologically, and of course there are differences, but this well-designed study, when you actually look at it and you account for social factors, it basically eliminates the gap in adverse events between men and women. So social factors rather than biological ones in this case. Bonus article 15. Colleges face gambling addiction among students as sports betting spreads. So this, we're having kind of an epidemic of gambling, and sports betting has really opened up in many states in recent years. And college kids, young people in general, but particularly colleges who are of age in order to be able to do the gambling, are much more prone, they're much more risk-taking, they don't have as well-developed most things psychologically or emotionally, so they're more susceptible, and you have about like double the rates of gambling addiction among college-age kids versus the adult population as a whole. So yet another epidemic we need to deal with. Bonus article 16 gets to a more traditional epidemic. Super meth and other drugs push crisis beyond opioids. Polyaddiction is making treatment far more difficult. So this is the more traditional addiction is to substances rather than, say, sports gambling or other gambling is one example, or eating or shopping or whatever. But polyaddiction, having more than one addiction, is been around for a long time, but particularly with these really powerful drugs, even more so than in addition to the opioids, is making treatment far more difficult. Bonus article 17, revisiting the black-white mental health paradox during the coronavirus pandemic. So this is a great overview. This is a scientific paper, but it's a good read. A layperson, I think, could get through it all right. And it really gets at this black-white mental health paradox is actually that black folks have many more stressors and disadvantages than white folks, but do as well or better than white folks on mental health indices. So it's somewhat of a paradox. And it really does allude, and this is a very good overview of the various mechanisms and theories about why this might be. And a lot of it does get to that kind of social and cultural factors that can produce health and resilience in a population. We can learn from that. Bonus article 18, race cannot be used to predict heart disease, Heart Association scientists say. So finally, they're taking race as one of the things in their little formulas for like predicting heart disease. While racialized populations suffer more heart disease, it's not because of the construct of race. It's that it's associated with other factors, and those factors, rather than, you know, checking a box of race, should actually be the things used to predict heart disease. Bonus article 19, why some seniors are choosing pot over pills. Older people are using cannabis more than ever. A primer on pot's potential medicinal benefits and side effects as we age. So there are a lot of issues with older people that aren't necessarily present with younger people. They're taking other drugs, it can be other interactions, there can be cognitive issues, a whole bunch of things. So if you're an older person, an old older person who's using or thinking about using cannabis, this would be a good article to read. Bonus article 20. Facing financial ruin as costs soar for elder care, as the United States has no coherent system providing long-term care. So again, compared to our peers in other countries, the U.S. really has no coherent system, and it's bringing financial ruin to older folks and their families. Bonus article 21, poor cost effectiveness of anti-obesity drugs in adolescents with severe obesity. So recommendations have come out for youth rather than just adults for these new anti-obesity drugs. But if you look at even the most severely obese and do a cost effectiveness, it's not very cost effective. It's got a very low level of cost effectiveness. For even the most severe cases among adolescents. Bonus article 22. Bayer ordered to pay $1.56 billion in latest U.S. trial loss over Roundup weed killer for doing harm, including causing cancer. Yep, that one just won't go away, and Bayer's trying to figure out a new legal strategy. Maybe it's not a good business plan to sell carcinogens. Bonus article 23. The 2023 report of the Lancet Countdown on Health and Climate Change, the imperative for health-centered response in a world facing irreversible harms. So this is just really a detailed roundup of basically, no pun intended for the previous story, Roundup Weed Killer, of fact that health needs to be really put in the center when we're looking at the harms of climate change. It's not just, you know, economic or some ethereal environmental change. If you look at it, the human health consequences are great and growing. Lastly, but not least, 24, it's not just extreme weather, climate-sensitive diseases spreading through the U.S. So this is just a more specific example of climate change affecting human health. This is in the U.S. and gives a good rundown summary. I reported on that before, but a good review. You can view these and all the other stories I've reported on in this episode or earlier episodes by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive. And go do it, because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.